Hi folks, welcome to the Epochs of Lotus Eaters. This is the third of a three-part series we're doing on the Duke of Wellington, the conqueror of Tipu Sultan, the liberator of the Iberian Peninsula, and now I suppose the nemesis of Napoleon.
Yeah.
So,
well, last time we left off where the Napoleonic forces had been beaten across Europe and Napoleon had been exiled to Elba.
The Emperor of Elba.
But he did escape. Now, I'm not going to do the 100 Days and Waterloo in all that much detail because I've sort of done it twice already. One in our series about Napoleon, and I also did a very early epochs reviewing the film, the 1970 film Waterloo with Critical Drinker. Do check that out.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go over it a bit, but I'm not going to do it in fantastic detail.
If you want the detail of what happened to Napoleon on Elba and how he got out, well, you can check out the previous epoch.
Yeah. Needless to say, he did escape from the island of Elba in the Mediterranean, came up through France, turned a lot of his marshals, including Soult and Ney, to come over to his side.
Will you shoot your emperor?
And and the Bourbon king, was it Louis XVIII, fled France. And so we get the showdown at the Field of Waterloo, which is just south of Brussels. So Napoleon decides he needs to march on the coalition forces or the British forces that are in Belgium.
So just a quick thing. What's Wellington been doing during the 100 Days? While Napoleon's at Elba?
Yeah, there was the Conference of Vienna where all the successful... the winning side of the Napoleonic Wars get together to sort of carve up Europe, a bit like a Treaty of Versailles. What are we going to do with our newly won peace? So there was the Conference of Vienna, and they hadn't got anywhere near the end of it. These big peace conferences take ages.
Yeah.
You know, Versailles took months and months and months.
So
you know?
It must have taken even longer back then.
Yeah. So they hadn't finished sort of wrangling over what they were going to do when news comes that Napoleon has escaped. Wellington, who was sort of the obvious choice to sort of lead the coalition or be at least one of the coalition commanders, was up in Brussels. As I say, Waterloo is just south of Brussels, really. And I won't go into this in fantastic detail, but the Prussian commander, Blücher, I've been pulled up on pronouncing that incorrectly before. Napoleon saw that we hadn't joined up our armies. We would be together, the Prussians and the British, would be sort of irresistible at that point. I mean, we outnumbered him on the day at Waterloo as it was. He had 70, 75 odd thousand men. We had 110, 120 odd thousand. So the classic thing and the correct thing to do is to put his army between us and the Prussians. The story famously goes that there was a ball going on when Wellington got the news that Napoleon and his marshals had crossed the Sambre River at Charleroi. They wasn't sure whether he was going to cross and go up towards Mons or a bit further east at Charleroi. But when he did cross at Charleroi, it was sort of clear that he wanted to divide us and the Prussians, which he did, ultimately to no avail.
Spoiler alert.
There was a battle 2 days before Waterloo. Some people think of it as just like a preliminary engagement, but it was pretty much a full-blown battle at Quatre Bras. Like, they lost 4,000-5,000 men, we lost 4,000-5,000 men. Like a full-blown thing, 25,000-30,000 aside.
Yes, only a minor engagement.
Right.
That's huge. Right.
Because Waterloo was a big battle.
Yeah.
You know, there were bigger ones, but not many. Like Leipzig, Austerlitz, Borodino are sort of bigger, but they are giant.
Yeah.
So Waterloo was big and very bloody. Very bloody one. No doubt about that. A few great quotes from Wellington. He said, I would at any time have rather heard that the French army had received a reinforcement of 40,000 men than that he, Napoleon, had arrived to take command. So again, it's one of the most famous battles in all of history, certainly
just
from an English point of view.
That quote tells you a lot about warfare generally. You know, very much the sort of army of lambs led by a lion, rather than an army of lions led by a lamb, as Alexander put it. You know, even like across that span of time, 2,000 years, it's still true. The commander doesn't have the gall, the guts, the grit to do aggressive things. Then it doesn't matter how good the soldiers are. And just a quick thing as well. Napoleon's lost most of his good soldiers as well, hasn't he? Hundreds of thousands of good soldiers. And so Napoleon's army is of much lower quality than it would have been in previous years.
For sure.
So
for sure. I mean, his campaigns are the best part of 20 years, and over that 20 years, his very, very best men had passed away.
Oh, yeah, that's that'd be a little less generous than that. He'd got his best men killed.
Yeah, and
hundreds of thousands of them.
I hadn't quite finished.
Sorry.
I was going to go on to say that, but particularly in the Russian campaign of 1812, most historians say that there, some sort of inner cadre, especially amongst his old guard, perished on that campaign, which was only like a year ago or two, 3 years ago now. But all throughout 1813, when he's on the retreat, just before his first abdication, he had to recruit really, really completely fresh, green, very young men.
Yeah.
So by 1815 here, it's a pale shadow of sort of the once great legions of veterans he once had at his command. It's not that anymore.
Yeah, because, I mean, the thing about Waterloo is I always thought, if Napoleon had had just his army in its heyday, it's quite easily possible that he would have won.
Yeah.
And swept us into the sea, turned and crushed the Prussians like he'd done previously.
Maybe.
Like, it's entirely possible that could have happened. And so it's just like,
absolutely, maybe. And he didn't have a good day.
Yeah. And Waterloo wasn't exactly a resounding victory. Well, I mean, it was obviously a decisive victory, but like, as Wellington puts it, nearest damn thing, run thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
So it was on a knife edge, even with Napoleon's inferior infantry and whatnot.
In the end, it was an absolutely decisive victory, but on the day, it was close. Famous quote. Damn close run thing, absolutely. So Napoleon, how much genius he displayed on the day of battle, towards the latter half of his career. Some days he was still great, and other days he wasn't. So in 1813, he quite often displayed some of his old genius, as good as he ever was. And then on other days, not so much.
On other days, he auto-combated it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on the day of Waterloo, he had a bit of a stinker, to be honest. He was ill that night, the night before. He was ill. And the morning, in fact, he was ill. Mm. So just a few details. It had rained all night and for a portion of the morning as well, to the point where the field at Waterloo was waterlogged and muddy. And that really, really hampered the sort of efficient movement of artillery pieces. Mm. Wheeled artillery pieces
probably didn't help the assault of the infantry either.
But especially on hillsides, Napoleon really couldn't do what he wanted. Because one of the things Napoleon was always famous for is just moving around his artillery very, very quickly and perfectly, all that sort of thing, and he just couldn't do it. So he had to wait, or he decided to try and wait. Didn't really have much option but to wait until the morning sun had sort of dried the ground out just enough that he could start doing all sorts of manoeuvres with his artillery. And so it wasn't until about 11:30 in the morning when things really started to kick off. That's fairly late in the day.
Mm.
With these big battles, Leipzig was 2 days, or even 3 days, was it? With these really, really big ones, you need the whole day, really, to do what you want, unless you get lucky.
Well, yeah.
So he's wasted a bit of the morning there.
Just a quick aside as well. At this point, Napoleon's suffering from all sorts of pathologies. Hasn't he got like syphilis and various other...
Well, we're not sure. I don't think he had syphilis, but what in the end, he died probably almost certainly of like a stomach cancer.
Right.
And he was probably suffering from that already.
Yeah. But the point is he had loads of ailments. I remember when I was in school, actually, seeing a textbook and it's a picture of Napoleon and just pointing, you know, the little bits pointing to each part of his body. And I was like, he had some sort of STD because it was mentioned on the thing. I can't remember what it was. But the point is he was just riddled with diseases and infirmities that he had accrued over 20 years of campaigning, you know, can't have been pleasant.
He was certainly no spring chicken anymore.
Yeah.
He was sort of firmly middle-aged and a bit overweight and probably dying.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't actually die for a few years.
But definitely, you know, suffering.
But yeah, he's beginning to suffer from the ailments that would eventually kill him. Often there's pictures of him. It was a fashion of the day to have one hand sort of in your tunic or something. But some people say maybe it was just he was constantly just holding his stomach because he was in pain all the time. Yeah. And it became a fashion to do that. But so again, just to sort of, I don't want to do Battle of Waterloo in fantastic detail, but to say there's like a couple of villages in the no man's land between the two lined up armies. Wellington later wrote, the enemy commenced a fierce attack upon our post at Hougoumont. I'm probably pronouncing that incorrectly.
It's fine. We pronounce everything incorrectly.
I had occupied it with a detachment of guards, and it was maintained throughout the day with the utmost gallantry. This was notwithstanding the repeated efforts of large bodies of the enemy. So Napoleon threw thousands of infantry at it and effectively it ultimately failed to take it. So again, he sort of wasted the whole morning, because now it's midday, or it's 1 o'clock, 1:30. He's wasted sort of half the day. Well, not wasted, he's tried and failed to...
I feel like we've rushed to Waterloo a bit quickly. I really wanted to know what Wellington was doing in the meantime. I mean, I assume he was just, okay, I'm going to nip back to Britain or whatever and get the army together. Like, what was his preparations prior to Waterloo?
Well, as I say, there was the Congress of Vienna.
Yeah.
So he was personally in Europe anyway.
Yeah, right.
And there was all sorts of...
But did we have an army? I suppose he had an army on the continent.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And so he just takes that army.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah.
When we'd heard that Napoleon had escaped.
Yeah.
And he starts his travel up through France, because he lands on the French Riviera at the very bottom of France and travels all the way up north. And when it becomes clear that the various marshals, like Ney, been sent to bring him back to Paris in an iron cage and have failed to do so.
His closest companions would have defected to his side and not this puppet king that we've installed. Yeah, I know, it's ridiculous.
Because it takes him about 3 months to do all this. It's not that quick.
Yeah.
Like I say, 100 days. The 100 days, more or less, effectively ends with that Waterloo.
Yeah.
So there's a 100-day period there. So in that sort of 3 months or so, we gather our forces and we know he's coming north. We know he's obviously going to march on Paris. So we coalesce our men in Brussels or in Belgium.
Right.
Wellington comes back from Vienna to Brussels because also, it's a classic thing, we know that if for whatever reason we forced us out, we're probably from Antwerp.
Right.
We'll probably bounce back to England if he does something brilliant. He never did.
But he might have done.
You're right.
So
that's really what he did. We knew it was coming.
Right.
He'd been in Paris for a while. He'd got to Paris, reinstalled his monarchy, formed a government, and then marched north to Brussels. Right. So we sort of know it's coming. We absolutely know it's coming. Like I said, 100 days is a fair bit of time, actually. It's not like he escaped Elba and 2 days later he's in Paris.
Oh, yeah.
Four days later he's trying to attack us at Belgium. No,
Okay.
That's really. So by 1:30 on the day of the battle, Napoleon decides to try and force the issue at La Haye Sainte, the second village. And he attacks it with about 16,000 infantry, a full-blooded assault. Doesn't actually quite take it, but he completely surrounds it and nearly wipes out the garrison there and pushes on forward towards our line. And that's quite a dangerous moment. All the historians of the battle, like, if that had pushed through, we would have, may well have been in trouble.
Mm.
It's at that point when Wenton decides to unleash his cavalry, or the Scots greys, where they quite literally ride grey horses. It was a sort of very famous, there's a famous painting of the charge of the Scots greys. And they do send the infantry packing there, but Napoleon counters them with his lancers, the French cavalry.
Yeah.
Or, well, Napoleon said, quote, "Those terrible grey horses, how they fight." But what they did the classic thing, centuries thing, of they push away this infantry attack and become drunk on that victory.
Chase after
and
them?
Chase, or go straight, try and crash straight into the main French lines and get cut to pieces, essentially. A retreat is called, but a lot of them are cut down during that recall. And so, yeah, the last giant great cavalry charge, not the last one, they're still cavalry charging World War One, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
but the last giant one ever done.
Or the so, I mean, this is probably like 20,000 men or something, right?
Yeah, it was loads, thousands and thousands of horse. Yeah. And it sort of fell foul of the thing you always worry about your cavalry falling foul of. You just did it again. It's like, ugh. How many centuries do we have to before the cavalrymen will learn?
Yeah.
They just never learn. Basically, cavalrymen essentially, not all of them always, but often was the case.
And it's always notable when it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Like at Calais or Alexander at Gaugamela and things like that. These are actually, but they're always battle winning maneuvers. If you can bring your cavalry back, you've won the battle, basically.
Quite possibly, yeah. Well, sometimes if the cavalry charge of heavy horse is truly irresistible and they start rolling up a flank, like then again, you've won the day. Yeah, so it's not.
Like a hussar charge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, there are many, many books written about Waterloo. It's one of the most famous battles of all time, certainly if you're an Englishman or European, Western European. So you could go into it in crazy, crazy detail. But as we've already done it a bit, I'll sort of skate over a bit. One thing to say is that Napoleon, in the middle of the day, feels ill and goes and has a bit of a snooze.
Yeah.
Goes into a barn behind the lines and sleeps for a bit, an hour or so. And during that moment, Ney, who's the head of the cavalry, thinks he sees a chink in our line, or does, is fooled into thinking that, and orders a giant cavalry charge against us. But Wellington has done that classic thing where the main body of his men are behind the ridge.
Mm.
So when the cavalry get there, they're actually confronted with lots of squares.
Yeah.
Most people know what squares are, but I'll put an image up so everyone can see exactly what it is.
Solid ranks of infantry who have their, not pike, what is it? The bayonets. Facing forward. So the horses won't charge into them, and then they're point blank range so they can just get blasted.
Mm.
So.
The square, by the early 19th century, the square was a brilliant foil against cavalry.
Yeah.
It was really good. It was extremely, extremely rare that cavalry, by the early 19th century anyway, would break into a well-formed, well-ordered square and break it apart and kill them all.
And when it did happen, it was memorialised in song and poem.
Right. So in the Peninsular War, the British cavalry did do it to the French, like, once or twice.
Hmm.
And again, it was sort of incredible. It's like, wow, you actually did it for once.
Yeah.
So it's not like it never happened, but it was quite rare. And what a great line from Wellington around this time of the battle. He said of Napoleon, "Damn the fellow, he is a mere pounder after all." So he thought, or hoped perhaps, that Napoleon might do something sort of truly unique or imaginative or something, and he just didn't. Again, he didn't have a good day.
Yeah.
Old Boney didn't have a good day that day.
Yes, they go have a lie down. But, I mean, he probably had stomach cancer, so, you know.
Yeah. I think he'd been up most of the night before in pain.
Mm.
So he was very tired. And, well, anyway, when he gets back, you can't, sort of can't believe what Ney's done.
So what happened to the cavalry, Ney? Well, half of it got massacred.
Yeah.
Called a giant charge. Thought we could do it.
You had one job, not to get all the cavalry massacred.
Yeah.
I leave you for 1 hour, and what do you do? Yeah. Well, Wellington himself had multiple horses shot out from under him. And was everywhere. And nearly everyone on his staff, I think nearly everyone on his staff was either killed or wounded, because he insisted on being right at the front to be able to see everything with his own eyeballs at all times and issue orders himself.
King micromanager must micromanage everything, even in the heat of the battle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was definitely within range of cancer. A couple of times during that portion of the battle, he had to take refuge inside a square himself. That's really, he's really close, really. Anyway, by about 6 p.m., things are becoming a bit worrisome from the French point of view, because the Prussians have turned up.
Yeah.
If he's going to win the day, he needs to win it right now.
Yeah.
So at one point he decides to send in the old guard, the last giant push of, hopefully an irresistible push of infantry columns. And
but Wellington's already figured out how to beat columns.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. And he had a lot of men sort of laying in wait for them, essentially. He said, the enemy made a desperate effort to force our centre near the farm of La Haye Sainte again. The farm, after a severe contest, was defeated. There's a few thousand men there, and I think only 42 survived, so they're basically wiped out.
Blimey.
But it wasn't enough, because when they pushed on forward into our line, we did stop them. Great line, Napoleon, Wellington said, night or the Prussians must come. He knew that without the Prussians' help, Napoleon could have pushed him off the field. But when the Prussians did arrive, Napoleon had sent some sort of detachment out to try and slow them down, but they'd pushed through him. Mm. When he did arrive late in the afternoon, Napoleon basically couldn't make his mind up exactly what to do for a while. Not all that long, but he paused, he hesitated for a bit, perhaps half an hour. The historian Richard Holmes, the late great Richard Holmes, said, quote, half an hour's doubt was undoing a lifetime's achievement. That just says it all.
Summarizes everything.
That just says it all. And at this point where Napoleon basically throws everything he's got left into the maelstrom, all his remaining artillery blasting away as much as they possibly could, Wellington said, quote, hard pounding this, gentlemen. Stand fast. We must not be beat.
So we're getting a good view of how things are from Napoleon's point of view.
Mm.
But what was it like from the British point of view, from Wellington? Because the French assault must have been bloody terrifying.
Yeah.
And so how are Wellington and the British doing at this point?
Right, well, he never lost his nerve. That's his classic thing, is that he never lost his nerve. Like that quote there, just stand fast. Another thing that perhaps gives you an idea of Wellesley's mindset is his second in command, Uxbridge, the Lord Uxbridge, Henry Paget, at one point right near the end of the day, gets his leg blown off.
Hmm.
You know that story?
Yeah.
And he's supposed to have said, by God, sir, I've lost my leg.
By God, sir, so you have.
Yeah, and he just turned and said that. Yeah. So it's like, again, his favourite horse, his charger, Copenhagen, he rode for some of the battle, but he sort of, when things got a bit too hot, he used other horses, and he had more than one shot out from under him, and yet he never lost his nerve, never lost his bottle.
Mm.
So it was always that sort of his mindset.
Mm.
But he knew it was extremely close. Like, at one point in the afternoon, he said, if the Prussians or night doesn't come, we are probably lost.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of the British regiments from a lot of the day just sort of had to stand there and just take the incoming artillery from the French.
Mm.
So it's sort of one of those exercises in nerve.
Yeah.
And
then you've got like various infantry charges.
Yeah.
Cavalry charges.
Like I say, the contest at La Haye Sainte was a bitter, bitter, bloody, last stand Alamo type deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really bad.
Yeah.
I mean, the casualties, to give you an idea, the French lost something in the order of 33,000 men out of about 73. We lost something in the order of 22,000
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, yeah.
That is atrocious.
It's a really bloody day. It really, really was.
But that's probably the worst Wellington's ever had.
Picton was killed. General Picton, one of Wellington's favourite, closest corps commanders.
Because didn't we have about 50,000 men and we were waiting for like another 50,000 from the Prussians?
Yeah, in that ballpark. Well, we had about 30,000 men. The Dutch gave us about 17,000.
Yeah.
We had another 11,000 from Hanover.
Right.
Well, I mean, and the Prussians, I mean, there's 6,000 from Brunswick.
Right.
And Blücher had 50,000 of his own.
Yeah.
So once we got together,
we had the bigger army.
We had in the order of 120,000 men.
But while Blücher's absent from the field, we're actually being overwhelmed by a greater number of Frenchmen who seem to be really going for it.
Oh, yeah. It was all or nothing.
Yeah.
It was absolutely all or nothing. I mean, Napoleon knew that if he lost that battle, that was it. There would be nothing. There's nothing between the Allies and Paris again.
Yeah.
He had no second, because he'd got together all his army corps. He'd got together pretty much everything he had within reason.
So I'm just trying to picture it from the British point of view, because it's just going to be constant musketry, charges, cavalry, thunder. You know, the ground would have been rumbling under your feet, you know, while booms in the distance. You know, you'd see the poof, 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 and then boom, 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 boom around you. And then you've just got the sort of just rows of French guys just shooting and charging and trying to pike you and stuff. And it just must have been absolute chaos, thundering chaos, with people screaming all around you. It must have been prior to World War One. It's hard to think of anything worse than the Battle of Waterloo. You know, 21,000 of the winners dead.
Yeah.
It's awful. That's atrocious. You know,
it's a slaughter. Yeah.
So it's just the whole thing is just like this awful, awful day.
Sometimes when you get hit with a cannonball, it will sort of blow you apart, blow you to bits.
Yeah.
There's accounts I've read from Waterloo where some get hit in the head with a cannonball and it just takes your head off entirely.
Yeah. Because the cannonball's quite big.
Yeah.
And when it's travelling a few hundred miles an hour, it just obliterates a human being.
Sometimes they might use grape shot or something, but often they use just a big old cannonball.
Yeah, because it'll just crash through lines.
Yeah. Sometimes they'll come sort of skipping towards you.
Yeah.
It's not just one trajectory. Sometimes it'll skip along. And there's a famous cavalryman's breastplate.
Yeah.
From Waterloo.
With just a huge hole.
Giant hole in the front and back of it.
Yeah.
Where a cannonball's just gone straight through him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just
a very bloody day.
Just to be clear, from the British side, and obviously from the French side as well, but like, from the British side, you've got to stand and defend essentially a ridge, a muddy, wet, cold ridge, under just this constant bombardment and constant infantry fire and cavalry charges and screams of pain and you firing your own gun back at them. Like, it just, the sensory overload is awful on this day. And you've got to stand there, because if you run away, you're dead.
Yeah, for some regiments of foot, your job that day was to basically stand there and get shot at all day long.
Yeah.
And when guys either side of you were shot or blown to pieces, you just shuffle up so there's no more hole. That's your job all day.
Yeah.
Crazy, really.
It's just mad just to think of what was, you know, what your senses were constantly bombarded with.
Mm.
And that's assuming you didn't get wounded. Assuming you didn't get killed. Mm. You know, it's just and there's a damn fine chance that you will. So, you know, it's just... Anyway, just a lot of suffering from the on the British side and the French side, obviously, but they're the bad guys, so don't care about them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, certainly among the more bloody battles.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.